before the age of electronic entertainment, back when we had to actually physically manipulate things to have fun, the Rubik's Cube was born. Now, what do you think the probability is that during the course of the next 30 minutes that somebody in our audience could actually solve the Rubik's Cube? What do you think? Sounds like fun. Why don't we try it? Now, if I give this to Mark, he won't be able to listen to the message. Because, you know, men cannot multitask. Women can listen, talk, and get something done all at the same time. Deidre, why don't you work on that? Okay, now what is the probability that two people could solve this Rubik's Cube in 30 minutes? What do you think? Medium? Cindy Robinson probably can. Okay, now here's the bigger question. What is the problem? Now you guys need to work on that. Seriously. Okay? What's the probability that both of these two can finish this Rubik's Cube puzzle at exactly the same moment? What's the probability? What we want you to do is we want you guys to work on this, Cindy and Deidre, and when you finish, I mean, we're optimistic this morning, when you finish, just raise your hand, and we're going to watch to see if you can do it exactly at the same time. Now, you can't look at each other. You can't say, okay, you get close, you know. Let's just see how that works. You say, what's that got to do with your message? I'm not sure yet, but I've always wondered this. Haven't you always wondered this? When it comes to this topic that we've been wrestling with about worldviews, it seems that the debate has already been settled. If you were to read this month's, actually it's October 2000, series magazine on popular science, they've got an article in this magazine, and the article is about the debate as to whether creation and science ought to be both taught in the school classroom at the same time. And a quote from the article says, you'd think that the matter would be settled now. After all, Darwin in 1859 published On Origin of the Species, the foundation of modern biology that holds that all species developed from earlier forms over millions of years through chance mutations and the process of natural selection. The article basically just communicates to us that, you know, why would people continue to debate what gets taught or presented in the classroom when it's just really obviously true that it's clear when you talk about Darwinian evolution, naturalism, that's pure science. And isn't the school supposed to teach science? On the other hand, they would say, in this article in Popular Science, that's what they say, is that the whole issue of creation or creator, that's religion. And based on separation of church and state, it's very, very clear that science, Darwinian evolution, ought to be taught, and that creationism, which is religion, not science, should not be taught. That's what Popular Science is saying right now. At the same time, we know that experiments have proven that scientists have been able to create human life. Going all the way back to 1953, we've got a guy who was famous because he, in the laboratory, put together a process by which he produced the amino acids, which are the basic building blocks of protein, which is an important component of DNA. And newspapers around the country reported that Stanley Miller had developed life in the test tube, therefore validating, according to science, that in that primordial soup of billions and billions and millions and billions of years ago, that life could have arisen spontaneously, and therefore science, naturalism, I'm using those terms together because that's the prevailing view, science has proven that human life basically evolved from a single cell amoeba or animal years ago, and that's the popular view. Now, the difficulty of that for you as a Christian places you in what I'm calling a proverbial rock and hard place. You know, if you're a Christian and you hold to creationism, then you're in a position where on one side of you, you've got science. And science is saying that the whole concept of a creator is out. It's not scientifically provable. It's not valid. We've proven another way. On the other side, you've got popular culture, and popular culture is saying, you know, get rid of those old Christian beliefs that hold us back and keep us from becoming what we want to be and keep us from doing what we want to do, and you find yourself squeezed from both sides. And what we want to suggest to you is that you can not just be between a rock and a hard place, but that you can literally become a rock in a hard place if you're standing on the foundation of truth. And what we've been discussing in this worldview series is the whole question of truth. What is really true? We've presented two competing worldviews. The first one is the Christian worldview. And in the Christian worldview, when you study the Bible and when you study Christianity, the Christian worldview says that there's an all-encompassing reality based on a creator. In fact, the fundamental question that all worldviews have to ask and answer is, where did I come from? How did I get here? And every worldview has to be able to address that issue successfully. The Christian worldview says that I came, or I'm here, because of an act of a supernatural creator, a God who placed me here. In fact, if you'll open your Bibles to the book of Genesis, chapter 1, we see that clearly spelled out in Genesis, chapter 1. Genesis, chapter 1. We have the creation of the universe, the creation of natural laws, we have the creation of earth, and then we have creation of the things that are on the earth. And starting in verse 20, we read, "And God said, let the waters teem with living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky. So God created the great creatures of the sea and every living moving thing with which the water teems according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number, and fill the earth, and fill the waters of the sea, and let the birds increase on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning the fifth day. 24. And God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kind, livestock, creatures that move along the ground, and wild animals, each according to its kind. And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that moved along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw it, that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness. Let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them." Now, in this passage, we see that what the Bible is saying is that God was literally the agent of creating the specific life forms that we see on earth today. He created the birds, he created the fish, he created the animals, and he created humans. Not only does it say that God created them, but he created them in a specific, frozen, immutable state. In other words, the early chapters of Genesis are saying that animals will reproduce or multiply after their kind. And it says it over and over again. Which flies in the face of Darwinian evolution, which says that basically the kinds are blurred as we see one form of life through random mutation and natural selection becoming another form of life over millions and billions of years and finally evolving to the place that man appears on the scene. So we have a conflict between the Christian worldview that God specifically created animals, God specifically created fish, God specifically created the birds, and also that God specifically created people. In fact, I want you to notice the specific creation of Adam in Genesis chapter 2, verse 7. Genesis 2 describes the process by which Adam was created, and in chapter 2, verse 7, it says, "The Lord God formed the man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being." Now, I told the ladies in the ladies' Bible study this week that if you call your husband or call another man dirt, you're half right. It says that God actually, personally, took the elements of earth. He shaped and crafted the human body of Adam, and then he breathed his life into Adam, and Adam became a living being. What this passage is telling us is that Adam did not evolve from some kind of higher primate into some kind of a Neanderthal, and then finally into modern man today, that God actually personally created the first man. Now that's basically the Christian perspective or the Christian worldview. In contrast to that, we have a naturalism worldview, or the worldview of naturalism, and it says that in answering the question, where did we come from, the specific answer to that is nature. We came from the blind forces of nature working through the process of evolution, natural selection, to get us here. Those are two competing worldviews. Let me give you an example. In the book Evolutionary Biology, which was a common textbook that was used at the college level in biology classes, it makes a statement, by coupling undirected, purposeless variations to the blind, uncaring process of natural selection, Darwin made theological or spiritual explanations of the life process superfluous. Now, this is a statement in a textbook teaching science. What they're saying is that the naturalistic explanation put forward by Darwin rendered any, quote, religious explanations of how we got here as unnecessary. In other words, we no longer have to speculate, we no longer have to guess, we no longer even have to be religious about this. We've got naturalistic explanations. Let me give you one more example. The National Association of Biology Teachers in the United States in 1995 published a statement about their belief, and here's what they said. Life is the outcome of, quote, an unsupervised, impersonal, unpredictable, and natural process. Now, this is the association of teachers that band together to teach truth, science, and their particular point of view, as they published in 1995, is that something besides an intelligent designer, something besides a creator, put this whole place together. That's anti-Christian worldview. That's a naturalism worldview. They received so much pressure from the public that in 1996 they took out the words unsupervised and impersonal. Because how would they know whether it was unsupervised, and how would they know whether it was impersonal? I mean, that's not science, that's speculation. But they left in unpredictable and natural process. In other words, you did not get here by the act of anything supernatural, by any kind of design or designer, by any kind of creative force, by any kind of God. You got here simply through the product of nature. Now, that's the naturalism worldview. Now, as I prepared to talk to you guys today about this, I really struggled because there is so much that could be said. We could spend the next 3 weeks, day and night, discussing all the issues involved. And we're not going to do that. I'm going to just take about 15 minutes to just present information to you and just let you, as a normal, rational person, evaluate the information. I'm going to give you four examples where I could have given you 40 or 400. But I'm just going to give you four arguments for you to think about. Now, some people have said to me, Tim, you know, here's the bottom line. I separate my beliefs from science, and I'm comfortable in that world. You know, I'm willing to accept, you know, Darwinian evolution on this side and Christianity on this side, and keep one of them for the way I view the world around me and keep the other one for my religious faith. And when I get to heaven, I'll stand before God. It doesn't matter to me what it did to get us here. I'll just accept whatever because I'm not worried about the two. I can live with two conflicting worldviews taking place inside of me at the same time, and I'm okay with that. I've got other people that have said to me, Tim, you know, it really doesn't matter to me. It really doesn't matter to me what the scientific community says. I just believe my Bible, and I don't care what other people say. I'm just going to take my Bible at face value. And what I would say to you is that God doesn't really want us to do that. In fact, in Psalm 19, the psalmist says, the heavens are declaring the glory of God, And the atmosphere is showing his handiwork. In other words, what God is telling us to do is not just stick our head in the sand or just accept what a scientist says at face value. What God is telling us to do is look. Look at the evidence. Look at creation. Look at the heavens. Look at what God has done and ask yourself the question, can I truly believe in a creator based on what I see, what I can observe, reality, or can I not? You see, I believe that God is completely comfortable with science because science will always bring you back to Him. There's no other explanation. And so this morning, I want to challenge some of the current scientific thinking, and you tell me what is more reasonable, what is more real, what is more true. How are we doing on those Rubik's Cubes? Done yet? Okay, well, oh, I forgot to tell you, the goal of the Rubik's Cube is to get all the sides to be one solid color. You know, that's part of the process. If you have an understanding of where you want to end up in the end, you know, kind of intelligent design, it's easier to actually get there. But of course, there's no such thing in the blind forces of nature, and so we don't know where we want to end up. Let's examine some of the evidence. What does the evidence support? In 1859, Darwin published his book, Origin of the Species. And in this book, he put forward a theory. And the question is that theory, which is purported to be truth and science, is that theory reasonable based on what we observe in the world in which we live? The first question takes us to the place where we really have to start because it's truly the only place where we could ever prove one way or the other whether the theory is true, and that's in the fossil record. When we go back and look at the fossil record, what do we see? Now, if you would postulate that Darwinian evolution is true, that life began in that primordial soup when a bolt of lightning or a flash of light or a certain amount of heat brought the right chemicals together to form the amino acids which formed the proteins which created the first living being, and that living being began through millions of years to go through a process of mutation and change, where it evolved to a higher form of life, and it evolved to a higher form of life, and it evolved to a higher form of life, and it evolved to a higher form of life, until finally it evolved to being a human. And that these changes are ever so slight along the way, this process of random mutation. When you looked at the fossil record, what would you expect to see? What would be normal? What would you expect to see? Wouldn't you expect to see transitionary fossils all the way along? That when you started at the oldest strata, you would find these simple forms, but you would see them changing. And you'd see them changing into more complex forms. You'd see them changing, and you'd begin to form fossils that people call the missing link or the in-between. You know, when you've got a reptile and the scales are turning into feathers, that you'd see some transitionary changes in the process along the way. In fact, even Darwin himself acknowledged that this was the primary issue. Let me tell you what he said on the origin of the species. Darwin said, "Why then is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain, and this perhaps is the most obvious and the gravest objection which can be urged against my theory." Now this was Darwin himself. And he was saying, the absence of seeing this in the fossil record is a slam dunk against my theory. Now, if you read Darwin, you will see that he is very angry at paleontologists and geologists for having not done a better job of digging and categorizing the fossil record. But 150 years have now gone since Darwin published his thesis. People have been looking for these transitionary fossils. And let me tell you what they're saying currently. In fact, Stephen Jay Gould, who's a paleontologist at Harvard, wrote a few years back, "The extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology." In other words, we all know in paleontology that it doesn't exist, but it's kind of our trade secret. We keep this to ourselves. He goes on to say, "The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of fossils." So when you open your biology textbook and you look at it, it shows this cool evolutionary tree. And on all the different branches, you see these higher life forms. What Stephen Gould is saying is that's all the fossils we have. We don't have the rest of the trunk. We don't have the we don't have all these transitions. After 150 years of looking, we still don't have that stuff. He says evolution based on the fossil record is inference, not evidence. Could we substitute the word faith for inference? Would that be a legitimate substitution? You know what Stephen Gould's done? And I appreciate that he's done it. He's changed his theory. He no longer believes that the process took place by random mutation and natural selection. He's developed a theory called punctuated equilibrium. In his theory of punctuated equilibrium, he believes that at certain punctuations throughout the history of these millions of years, certain dramatic, unprecedented changes took place. For example, a reptile lays eggs, and out of one of those eggs, a bird hatches. Now, you may think that that sounds completely bizarre, which I do, but when you study the fossil record, that's the closest thing you can come. Because when we see the fossil record, we don't see the transitionary changes. All we see we're seeing animals, birds, reptiles, we're seeing living forms emerge fully formed and live out their life in the fossil record and those who go to extinction with only slight modifications, only minor changes, no macroevolution taking place. And so, the problem with that is, in the 1930s, Ernest Haeckel put forward that same concept. He called it the hopeful monster theory, and scientists laughed him out of science for suggesting that process. And yet that's what they're going back to, or some of the guys are going back to, because the record doesn't support what they're saying is the truth. Now that's one example. Let me give you a second. How about probability? Everybody says, well, you know, it seems really improbable that a single cell amoeba could at some point in time form into a human, but given millions and millions and billions of years, who knows what could have happened? In fact, in this magazine, Popular Science, they say in there, basically the statement that's made in there is, given enough time, that which appears to be impossible becomes probable, or becomes possible over millions of years. Well, the question is that true? Is something like that possible? Well, for a long time, nobody challenged that because nobody could fathom what billions of years would look like. But in the 1960s, with the advent of the computer, many mathematicians began to start writing programs on probability. And they began to run the statistics and the data and the possibilities through their computer programs. And as they did that, they began to come up with possibilities, mathematical possibilities. And so they turned their focus on evolution. And they took the neo-Darwinian thinking and they began to plug in all of the variables that they could come up with for this process of evolution and postulated with as many billions of years as you want to postulate, what is the probability that this could have happened? You know what the probability was that they came up with? Zero. Given millions, billions, an infinite amount of time, the process of evolution, the way Darwin explained it, could come up with was zero. In fact, they had a big meeting in 1966, a symposium at the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia, and there two men, Murray Eden of MIT and Marcel Schultenberger of the University of Paris, presented their findings on the statistical probability of evolution taking place to a group of biologists. And they basically said, guys, there's no probability that this would ever happen. It couldn't happen. The biologists at first were very angry about it, but through the course of dialogue, they were finally convinced through the data that this is true. This could not have happened the way Darwin explained it. And since that time, many biologists have charted new courses trying to figure out another way that this could have come about. However, when you study the textbooks, when you read what's being taught, when you look at what occurs in magazines like Popular Science, you know what's being taught? The standard Darwinian evolutionary line right down to the T, even though many in the field today recognize that Darwin's thinking here is obviously flawed. It could not happen. I love the analogy that was given. by Sir Frederick Hoyle, who was an astronomer. As he evaluated the possibilities, here's what he said. He said, if you were to take a group of blind people and line them up, he said, you'd need to take 10 with 50 zeros behind it, whatever that number would be. My son would say, is that a gazillion, Dad? I don't know, but if you took 10 with 50 zeros lined up behind it, and you took that many blind people and you lined them up, and you handed them all a scrambled Rubik's Cube, what would be the probability that they would all finish it at the exact same moment? That's the probability of evolution, according to Darwin's scheme, actually taking place. Now let me ask you a question. Is that a faith statement? Do you have to be stretched in your belief to put your arms around that kind of thinking? By the way, how are we coming? You guys getting close? We're still counting on you to break the probability. Let's look at the biological information. When Darwin put forward his theory, the thought was that the most simple cell was a very basic, simplistic piece of blob matter. In fact, that's what I was taught. You were probably taught the same thing in school, that, you know, the cell is so basic, it's very simplistic, there's not a lot to it. Well, we know now, because of DNA, that that is as far from the truth as you could possibly get. What is contained in an individual human cell is a strand of DNA that has more information than all of Encyclopedia Britannica, all 30 volumes, 3 and 4 times over. We're not talking in a single cell, that strand of DNA, we're not talking about a very, very simplistic thing. We're talking about information that is so advanced, so wild, so deep, so detailed, that scientists have been working for years and years and years just to try to map the thing out to understand it all. We're no longer saying that we had a little bit of protoplasm that kind of evolved a bump, and then it evolved another bump, and then it evolved another bump, and then another, and it had limbs. That's not what we're saying. We're not talking about the length of nose or the color of skin or the color of fur or whether an animal can run quickly or not run as quickly. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about major changes in a bunch of information that is very, very difficult to put together. And so we wrestle with that whole idea of how in the world did DNA evolve? How could this complicated strand of information evolve? What the scientists would say is, listen, it couldn't have been God, right? Because science only deals with things related to nature. So we have to do pure science and stay in the realm of nature. And if you try to interject that there was a designer who designed this thing, then you're moving into the field of religion. Is that a true argument? Let me suggest that science uses intelligent design every day. Let me give you some examples. In the whole field of pathology, when a pathologist comes to a dead body, what does he do? He looks at the dead body to discover whether the person died of what? Natural causes, or whether the person died of intelligent design, like murder. That's his job. He looks at the evidence in the body, and he says, did the natural processes of the body cause the death of this person, or was there some outside intelligent person that did the dastardly deed? Intelligent design in science? Yes. Let me give you another example, archaeology. An archaeologist comes across a strange-looking rock, and he begins to evaluate. Did this rock become strange-looking through the natural course of life, erosion, wind, heat, volcanic activity? Or did this rock take on this strange shape because there was an intelligent designer who was chiseling away at it to shape it in this form? Archaeology, another form of science, uses the theory of intelligent creation in order to explain the data that it looks at. Let me give you another one. Cryptology. A cryptologist studies information on a page to try to determine whether it's just random information or whether somebody's actually inscribed a code, whether there's something intelligent here that can be broken to figure out what the language is on the page. Let me give you one more. Astronomy. In 1966 or 1967, something really strange happened. Astronomers began to tune in and they heard radio frequencies coming from outer space. They began immediately to postulate that there was some kind of an intelligent life form in outer space. So they turned their telescopes and they turned their listening devices toward outer space in the direction of these radio signals, thinking that they had found aliens. You know what they'd really discovered? They discovered a pulsar. A pulsar is a star that wobbles, and in its rotation, as it wobbles in its rotation, it sends forth signals that mimic what we know as radio waves. How did they determine that it was natural and not intelligent? Because the patterns were systematic enough that they could tell that there was no form of intelligence there. I've given you four examples from four fields of scientific study that when they look at the evidence, they're willing to say, you know what? As we look at the evidence, maybe there was a creator, a designer, an intelligent person that influenced what we see in the data, and they're willing to factor that in. Why not when it comes to the creation of life? Why not when it comes to the development of the process that we look at today that we call human origins? Is it bad science when you look at design and you see design to say, hey, there must have been a designer? Is that bad science? Is that unintelligent? Let me give you one more example. This is the example of irreducible complexity. Irreducible complexity. What we mean by irreducible complexity, and hang in there, it's not that hard to understand. Irreducible complexity says that there are some systems that are so complex that if you take any part out of it, it will not work. For example, if you take the optic nerve out of the eye, you will not see. Remove the rods and the cones, you will not see. Remove the pupil, you will not see. Remove the iris. If you take any part away from the human eye, what happens? It doesn't work anymore, right? You've got to have everything present for it to work. So in an evolutionary process, to get from a single cell to a multi-complex system that needs every single part to work effectively, you've got to understand how each of these pieces evolved intact along the way. And that's very significant. What would happen to a fish that evolved a set of lungs? What would happen to it? It would drown, right? It wouldn't survive. It would drown. It would have to have changes in its respiratory system, circulatory system, its limbs, its skeletal system, all of its structure to be able to survive on land. It's irreducibly complex as an organism. The guy who developed this whole set of thinking is a guy named Michael Behe, who's a professor of biochemistry at Lehigh University, and he uses the example of mousetrap. He says, if you were to take a mousetrap and work backwards in the evolutionary process, you would have to suppose that originally the mousetrap started simply as a block of wood, and that block of wood used to catch mice, but it didn't catch that many, so eventually through the process of evolution, it evolved a spring. And it caught more with the spring, but it didn't catch as many as it should, so it eventually evolved a hammer, and now with the hammer, spring, and wood, it caught more than it did before, but it really needed a hook to hold the hammer, and it caught more with the hook, but eventually when it evolved bait, then it truly was capable of doing what it was designed to do, and it caught the most mice. And what you would say is, that's ridiculous. If you remove any single piece of the puzzle along the way, the mouse trap does not work. Irreducible complexity. And so today, the most automated modern factory, with its robots, computers, and everything all coordinated with split-second timing to be able to operate, is not as complicated as one single cell of the human body in its DNA. Now you ask me, could you ever postulate a modern factory coming together without intelligent design? You say, no possible way. Everything we know about information would say that would never happen. Well, how in the world could you then postulate that a single strand of human DNA could come together through some kind of strange chance process. It takes a lot of faith to embrace that. And Darwin understood this. Let me tell you what he says about irreducible complexity. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. You know what Darwin said when he was asked to explain the human eye? He said, "I shudder at trying to explain the human eye on the basis of my theory." The guy who developed the theory said, "Test my theory against the fossil record. If the fossil record doesn't hold, then my theory can't hold." In addition to that, he didn't know about probabilities because he didn't have the computers. In addition to that, he didn't know about the structure of the cell because he didn't understand DNA. In addition to that, he comes back and says, irreducible complexity is a prerequisite for my system working. And he understands that it doesn't happen. So what do you have when you're all done? What you have when you're all done is a theory. And my question to you is, does it take more faith to embrace this theory, or does it take less faith? I would suggest to you that it takes a lot of faith to believe in Christianity. It takes a lot of faith to believe in God. It takes a lot of faith. But it takes much more faith to believe in Darwinian evolution than it does to postulate an intelligent designer for the universe. So we come back to being a rock in a hard place. And let me summarize by reading something that Chuck Colson said. He says, many Christians are nervous about invoking God to answer any scientific questions, even the origin of life. We're afraid of being accused of resorting to the God of the gaps argument, of using God to cover over us. This fear is understandable given the fact that Christians often have been cast into the same category as primitives who attribute thunder to the raging of their gods. But there are times when Christians ought to turn the tables on the critics. There are times when it is more rational to accept a supernatural explanation and when it is actually irrational to hold to a naturalistic explanation. We know from science itself that there are some things nature cannot do. We know that we will never fulfill the alchemist's dream of chemically transmuting gold into or lead into gold. And we know that the parent of one species will never give birth to the offspring of another species. To persist in seeking natural laws in such cases is as irrational as any primitive myth of thunder gods. Science reveals consistent patterns that allow us to make negative statements about what natural forces cannot do. Empirical evidence makes it clear that the natural forces do not produce structures with high information content, namely DNA. This is not a statement about our ignorance, a gap in knowledge that will be filled in later by natural explanation. Rather, it is a statement about what we know, about our consistent experience of the character of natural processes. Today, holding on to the hope that some natural process will be found to explain DNA is supremely irrational. The elusive process that naturalists hope to find would have to be completely unprecedented, different in any kind from anything that we currently know. Surely, this is an argument from ignorance. When it comes to the origin of life, science is squarely on the side of creation by an intelligent agent. We have nothing to fear from the progress of science. And what I would suggest to you is that science is Christianity's best friend. Because the more you study what you see, the heavens are telling the glory of God. And anybody that makes their life pursuit true, legitimate inquiry into science is going to come to reasonable conclusions that point to a Christian worldview. It's happened over and over again throughout the history of the world. The problem is that today we've got a monolith out there, primarily purported by people that just don't know, headline media, that are telling us things that are just absolutely not scientific. And oftentimes we fall for it, we buy it, we assume it's true, we let our kids learn it. When our kids learn it, we let that become part of their worldview. And we grow up generation after generation, moving further and further and further away from a biblical worldview. Now, I could take hours and hours to go on, and we're not going to do that this morning, but there's so much more. I could tell you about reputable scientists that have fabricated experiments and later admitted to it in order to prove their thesis and get the grant that they were after. And the funny thing about it is those experiments are still published in textbooks today that students are reading as fact. Why is that? Well, next week we're going to get into the implications of naturalism, because I would suggest to you that a naturalistic worldview is responsible for so many of the evils in our world today. The most educated, most affluent generation of people, and in the last 100 years, the 20th century, since Darwinian evolution has become the watchword of contemporary thinking, we have seen more people die in the world through war and through politically motivated mayhem than ever in the history of the world. And you got to stop and ask yourself the question, why? The reason is because ideas have consequences. And when people move away from truth, the result is mayhem and chaos and confusion in the world. And that's why as Christians, we've got to stand on the truth and embrace it. I would just recommend one thing to you as we wrap up. Oh, by the way, how are we doing? It's not going to happen, is it? I know some of you are thinking, now I could do that because I've got the book. I didn't know there was a book, but my brother, who's an engineer, he told me there's a book that actually tells you how to do that. You know, I bet that book was written by an intelligent designer. See, here's the crazy thing. Everything we know about logic and reality speaks against random chance for complex systems and information. How many of you would ever postulate that the computer sitting on your desk got there by chance? And you're more complicated than that computer. Anyway, here's a book called Defeating Darwinism by Opening Minds, written by Philip Johnson. He's dumbed this book down to a junior high level, which is about where most of us read. And it's real good, real easy to read, real easy to follow. But the point is that when you do good science, when you think logically, when you look at the world around you, there's nothing to fear from science, because science speaks to the glory of God. And we may be in the minority of opinion, but when you're standing on the truth, it doesn't make any difference whether you're in the majority or the minority, because truth prevails. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Father in heaven, as we come before you this morning, we just want to confess that the incredible creation that you put together has been chalked up to chance by so many people in our world. And Father, at times we've even been guilty of thinking that too. And we just want to apologize to you and say, you did a great job. You did a great job when you made this world, and your fingerprints are all over it. Give us the courage to embrace that. Give us the faith to believe the rational and not the irrational. And help us to be able to go out into this community and communicate, not belligerent or mean or mean-spirited thinking, or ever be proud, but just to tell the truth. Encourage people to look for themselves and watch the changed lives that occur as a result. Father, we just praise you in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.